Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Fundamentals Podcast. I am your host, Harley. Joining me on today's episode is the third host of the James Bond A to Z podcast, Tom Butler. Tom was kind enough to reach out to me and suggest a topic for the show that I could not wait to get into, and that is Jurassic Park. Jurassic Park is one of those films that, very much like Jaws in the early episodes of this podcast, it's just so big, and when you get into it, you realise that it goes beyond simply being a film. It's something that's had a massive impact on pop culture since its release in 1993, and there's so much that we discuss. This is one of those episodes that really introduces a topic that I think many of us feel like we know everything about, but once we get into it, you'll realise that there's so much more to discover. In fact, I guarantee after this discussion, you will never look at Jurassic Park the same way. Just a quick little thing before we get into the episode. My audio on this was a little bit echoey. I was having some issues when I was recording a couple of episodes during this period, but it's not too bad. You can still hear me. It just sounds like I'm a little bit distant from the microphone. But Tom sounded amazing, and that's what matters. So, without further ado, let's get to the episode. This is Jurassic Park with Tom Butler. Hello, Tom, and welcome to the Fundamentals Podcast.
Hello, Harley. Thank you for having me.
Oh, pleasure's all mine. And you've come to me with a topic that I'm personally really excited to talk about, and with some insight as well, which I think the audience will absolutely love. And that is, of course, Jurassic Park. So before we get into it, I just want to ask you, when did this interest in the film start? When did you first see it?
The interest in the film, I think, began in the run-up to the film. I quite vividly remember I was very heavily into dinosaurs as a child, as many children are. It's I think it's a rite of passage for a lot of children to be, you know, really into their dinosaurs. I was heavily into reading about them, learning about them. Fossils as well. You know, I used to love digging through piles of rocks, looking for fossils, things like that. It was a real passion of mine. And at the same sort of time, so I would have been, I think, about between 10 and 11 when I read, I was really getting into reading books as well. So I was always a quite a heavy reader at school. My dad always used to say that he took me to the library once and they had to move me up a section because I'd read every single book in the kids section, and so they had to move me up to the teenage section. I don't know how true that is. I don't think that's exactly true, but I was definitely very passionate about reading. Yeah. I started off with, you know, the typical Roald Dahl type things, read all blitzed through all those, and I think at about sort of 10 and 11 I was just sort of starting to explore fiction for a more mature age. Like I said, I'd read a lot of kids' books. I think I was just sort of ready for whatever the next step was. And I think the very first thing, or at least one of the very first adult books I remember reading, was Michael Crichton's Jurassic Park.
Right.
And I think I became aware of it through just being aware that there was this film coming, Jurassic Park, and it was being directed by Steven Spielberg, who had done, you know, some of my favourite films of that time. So Jaws, E.T., Close Encounters, these were all like seminal films for me growing up. And so this idea that this film was coming, it was by Steven Spielberg, it was about dinosaurs, and I could read the book about it, was just, it just really piqued my interest. And so then I got the book. I've still got my copy of the book. I can show it to you now.
Oh, awesome.
It's a big hardback book.
Nice.
And the version that I got has the Jurassic Park logo on the front.
Yeah.
But it's a dual, it's a double book, and it's backed with Michael Crichton's Congo as well.
Wow. Okay.
Which is an earlier book of his.
Yeah, yeah.
On a very loosely similar theme, I guess.
Yeah, yeah.
And so that's the long and sort of winding road to where I got to introduced to Jurassic Park was through books and dinosaurs, and a love of blockbuster cinema as well.
It sounds like the perfect storm. I have actually read the book myself. I think I read it as a kid and recently got into audiobooks, and that was one of the first ones I put on the list. I thought, yeah, I'll re-listen to Jurassic Park. And I have to say, as a book, it actually stands alone quite well. You know, it's one of those, if I always say to people, like, it's worth a read. If someone's listening and they've never given the novel a go, I'd absolutely recommend it. I don't know about yourself.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. And it's actually quite surprisingly different to the film in terms of the tone and the style. All the basic ideas are there. I mean, that's the fundamental hook, isn't it? It's the it's the theme park filled with dinosaurs. That's like such a killer log line for anything. But the book is very different, and the characters are different. Like specifically the two kids, that they're switched round. So I think Lex is the younger one of the two, and she gets much less to do in the book. She's much more of a whiny child. And I think there's like bigger roles for Gennaro, the lawyer. It's been a while since I've read it, to be honest, but it's one of those books I'll go back to every few years and just really like lose yourself in it. And yeah, I would highly recommend reading it, definitely. But it is, like I said, it's very different. It has been adapted well, I think. It's one of those examples where the film, I think, is probably better than the book, but the book is well worth reading.
Absolutely. And yeah, when you get to the film, as you say, it does feel like a bit of a tall order to adapt, because as you said, the concept, it sort of screams Hollywood blockbuster, doesn't it? You know, like, yeah, big dinosaurs in the park. But as you say, the book is quite dense. There's quite a lot of... I see there's quite a lot of horror themes in it. You know, there's a lot of stuff that happens in the book, which is really tense and terrifying. So when you say, oh yeah, Steven Spielberg is going to direct it, you think, okay, yeah, I can, you know, he's done Jaws. Yeah, I can see that. But it's been a while, you know, since he's done something like that. He's done a lot of, as you say, like, you know, E.T. and Close Encounters, a lot of sort of family-friendly films. This is sort of the period in his career where he's very focused on that. So you think, well, how's that going to translate into a movie? And the answer is, well, arguably one of the greatest films ever made, right?
Yeah, definitely. I think so. Yeah, he was just coming off the back of making Hook. And you say that, like, you know, this is a book that's very well lent to being made into a film. And I believe the bidding war for the movie rights, you know, happened before the book even came out. It
really?
Was such a big hit before it even came out. Yeah, just this idea of the dinosaur park. It really captured imaginations, and yeah, was snapped up very early. And then there was like a bidding war between the different studios who was going to take it on. So I don't think it was long between the book coming out and the film coming out, actually. And you're right, Spielberg was very much in a not necessarily just family films, but like yeah, that's what he was known for. But he later on said that he was looking to be able to make a sequel to Jaws, but on land.
Right. Okay.
And so that's where he sort of saw how he would fit in with the project. So he'd done Jaws all those years ago, what, 75, and now it was like 93. It was nearly 20 years since he'd done that. He was ready to excuse the pun, sink his teeth into something of a similar nature. And yeah, he was, just the perfect person to bring this film to life. So, yeah, I mean, he's not the only person involved with this, but his fingerprints are all over it.
No, absolutely. And it's one of those that it does very much feel like a Spielberg film, but in the best possible way. And, you know, it becomes one of the most successful and biggest films ever. But really, I think there's so much more to it than that, right? It's not just a big Hollywood blockbuster that's all shiny and like people go, yeah, it's great, but whatever. It's just a film about dinosaurs. There's a bit more to it, isn't there, Tom?
Much more, yeah. I think the thing is this is a film, and I'm only really talking about the original Jurassic Park, the first film. I'm a big fan. I'm a big fan of Lost World, the second one.
Okay.
I've got a lot of time for Jurassic Park 3. But the more recent ones, I'm not really interested. And I think the difference is that with Jurassic Park, so first and foremost, it's a brilliantly made film.
Mm-hmm.
It is, it's a thrilling movie from start to finish. Mm. Okay. It's every single detail has been thought through, labored over. And the script, they've really honed in on what makes the story interesting. And if you were to compare it to other films of a similar nature, sort of monster movies from that era,
mm-hmm.
it really stands apart because it's I know it's silly to say, but it's very much grounded in realism.
Right.
It's a science. It's not necessarily science fiction. It's science possibility. Do you know what I mean? Mm. It's like it has this explanation behind it, and then. So you've got that. It's a very grounded film. Everything's feels real. Everything feels textured, and that even extends to the dinosaurs. And so, the thing about the dinosaurs is that you've got to remember at this stage in Hollywood, all the dinosaurs we'd seen on screen up to this point had been stop motion. You know, Ray Harryhausen type dinosaurs. Dinosaurs that only ever lived in our imaginations. And this film brings the dinosaurs to life. And to think that this is like, I was reading before I came onto the podcast, I was just sort of rereading one of my old making of books. And one of the animators working on the dinosaurs was doing it, the wireframe animations using an Amiga computer. And I don't know if you remember these computers.
Yeah, yeah.
But these were like basic. These are like very, very basic. And that's how they were animating these things. So, that it's like it's not just a great film, it's technically a brilliant film. The music's great, but really also it's a very cerebral film. The people spend their time throughout the movie talking about the ethics of dinosaurs, and that's the core of it. And then layered over the top of that is you've got the interpersonal relationships between Alan Grant, Ellie Sattler, Ian Malcolm to a lesser extent, and sort of how the film becomes about the responsibilities of bringing life into the world.
Mm.
And so you've got all this stuff going on, and then the film is thrilling as well on top of that. Whereas when you look to something like Jurassic World or even like the Godzilla movies that we have now, it's all spectacle and everything else is an afterthought. Something that always surprises people to learn is there's only 15 minutes of dinosaurs in Jurassic Park. That's how long they're on screen for, 15 minutes.
That's a good point, actually, yeah. I hadn't thought of that, but you're right. Yeah.
They're literally on screen for 15 minutes. So what is the rest of the film doing? It's spending the rest of the time building atmosphere, building tension.
Mm.
It's not all about the dinosaurs and explosions and all that sort of stuff. Which I think is something that, you know, Jurassic World, you could argue, does fall into that trap, unfortunately. Yeah. But yeah, it's just it's a masterful film on all the technical levels. And then also, you know, sort of the hidden stuff that people maybe don't think about, but like the music is incredible.
Yeah.
I went to see this for the first time in 4DX just after lockdown. It was like they literally just opened the cinemas again. And they put Jurassic Park on in 4DX in my local cinema, and I went to see it.
Amazing.
And the soundtrack, I'm not even kidding when I say, you know, it almost brought tears to my eyes. Like it just sounded incredible. Yeah, it's easy to forget all that stuff because you've seen it so many times, and you know it off by heart and all that sort of stuff. But when you see it again on the big screen and hear that music and the John Williams score, it's stunning. And that's without even talking about the performances of the actors as well, you know.
Mm.
But I feel like I've gone on a bit there.
No, it's fine. it's great. And I agree with all your points. And that's the thing, I think. Something that makes a film truly spectacular in the way that Jurassic Park is. It is a combination of all these ingredients coming together so beautifully. And I mean, as you say, the score is, I think, one of the first things people would think of. Say Jurassic Park, you're going to hear one or two of the different songs from, I mean, they're all iconic, but there's a couple of key ones that you'll go, oh yeah, you'll start, you can hum it. That's how iconic it is. And it's, you know, it's just John Williams, you know, being the legend that he is in cinema.
And it just conjures up that image of the helicopter coming into land. And
exactly.
It just brings goosebumps to me just thinking about it. Mm. And I think also as iconic as the music is the logo for the film.
Yes.
It's instantly recognisable. The combination of the yellow and the black and the red. This logo, I believe, came from the original book cover. So it was by this designer, this iconic book designer called Chip Kidd.
Uh-huh.
And he basically was tasked with designing the cover for the book. And he went out exploring, searching for inspiration. He ended up at a museum and he saw the dinosaur skeletons and they were lit from behind. And he noticed, you know, you're looking at dinosaurs in silhouette. And that idea sort of just sparked this idea for the cover of the book. And that's where the logo comes from. It's from this silhouette of the skeleton. And the way that on the book cover, it was black on white, or in fact, dark green on white. And then for the film, I think it was one of the very first things they did was design this logo for it, because you can see in the set photos, they've got it on all the jackets, on the hats. In fact, I think it's even in the shops, in the Jurassic Park shop.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's just such a beautifully simple logo. And they've never tampered with it. They do tamper with it a little bit for the sequels and what have you, but it stays the same. Do you know what I mean? It's like, it doesn't, it's there. It's one of the few film logos, I think, you know, that's instantly associated with the film. And that goes a long way in keeping things in your memory, I think. I can only think of really Star Wars, which has the sort of similarly iconic logo. I'm sure people probably say, oh, maybe Jaws, maybe, but that's just the word Jaws, isn't it? It's but I think that goes a long way of keeping it in people's memories, definitely, along with the music as well.
Absolutely, and it kind of helps with world building in the film. And I was just, as you were saying about it, I was thinking about the fact that, as you say, you see it everywhere on the island, on all the cars and, you know, bottles of water, hats, jackets. It just feels lived in, and it kind of helps to bring, I think, a level of realism. It's something so subtle and so simple, but the fact that you can take the logo that goes on the poster for this film and you've just slapped it all over the island, and at no point does it take you out of the film, or do you go, that's a bit weird? You kind of just go, yeah, that's the logo. That's the Jurassic Park logo. And you don't think about it, and it's just part of that world. It's, as you say, it's so much thought and design as goes into even the small details, which is exactly what you'd expect from a theme park, right? Every inch of it would be overlooked.
Exactly. Everything would be branded. Everything would be franchised. Yeah. There's a great scene in the film where they're talking over dinner. I don't know if you remember it, but they're having like a dinner scene, and Hammond is talking to Ellie and Alan, and Ian Malcolm, the lawyer's there, and they've got ideas, different ideas for the theme park running on the walls behind them. They're talking about, you know, having a coupon day. I think one of them is even like dinosaur tennis or something ridiculous. It's like, what is dinosaur tennis? But it's that real, that it's that, you know, that's how exactly how you would imagine a dinosaur theme park to be envisaged. And I think also something as well that the original Jurassic Park gets really gets across really well is that this is a theme park some sort of resort that is not finished. It's in early stages. It's in that sort of primacy of its life. And every single detail really captures that. And you're right, like the logos on the car, the way that he pulls the goggles out, the night vision goggles from under the car, and they're still wrapped up in bubble wrap.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, anyone else with as less attention to detail might have missed all this stuff.
Mm.
But, you know, you're working with a master filmmaker here who knows exactly what he's doing. And it all adds to it. It's terrific stuff.
It really is. And as you say, even just thinking about the visual side of it, I think it adds so much to it. Not only is there spectacle, as you say, like anyone, I would encourage anyone to go and watch the behind the scenes stuff, because I'm like you, I've dived into the making of this. When I was a kid, I had this on DVD and VHS, and they had all the behind the scenes. I used to watch them over and over because I was just fascinated by how they did it. And it's one of those examples of a film that, yes, it was pushing the boundaries in terms of CGI, but it used it sparingly, you know, used it when it needed to. And then you've got other scenes, like I'm sure people can immediately envision the T-Rex coming out of the paddock. And you've got this perfect blend of every sort of long wide shot being CG. And then you've got all the up close stuff is a big, real mechanical thing that they've built. And you watch the behind the scenes, that thing is terrifying backstage. Yeah. It looks incredible. And the thing is, it helps it to age really well. So that you can watch it now, you know, and I'm literally picturing in my head right now a scene of, you know, where it's got one foot on the Jeep and it's got some tire in its mouth and is screaming. It's such a striking image that doesn't age because they built it, you know, and it gives it that real tangible feel, which is what you want from a monster in a film.
Yeah, I mean, the visual effects in this film are outstanding. When this film came out in 93, the film that came before it that really captured everyone's attention with CG was Terminator 2.
Yeah.
And the guy who did the effects on that, Dennis Muren, was the guy who then came over from Terminator 2 to work straight onto Jurassic Park. And I think when they started the film, it was one of the first things they really had to crack, which was how to do the dinosaurs, right? It's the film lives or dies on its dinosaurs.
Yeah.
And so Spielberg basically assembled the best people in the industry for it, right? You'll notice that this film doesn't have movie stars in it. The movie stars in this film, he spent the movie star money on the technicians to make the dinosaurs right. Yeah. And he talks about that actually in the making of stuff. So he brought in Stan Winston, who does the practical effects. And Stan Winston was the guy who would build the puppets and the stuff that moved, the animatronics, that sort of stuff. You got Dennis Muren, who would do the computer stuff, the special effects and the CGI. And when he was brought in, they were thinking that they would use CGI for very, very, very few little bits and bobs. I think for the flocking of the Gallimimus scene, that's what they were brought in to do.
Yeah.
And it was only through tests that he did on what the T-Rex could look like that convinced Spielberg, Kathy Kennedy, Frank Marshall, the producers on this film, that actually we can do most of it with CGI.
Yeah.
And then the third person that they turned to was Phil Tippett. And now Phil Tippett is like a stop motion pioneer. So he was very much from the Ray Harryhausen school of, you know, taking a clay object, moving it slightly a bit, taking a picture, moving it slightly a bit, and that sort of thing. And he was brought in to animate, or so he thought, some of the raptor sequences. And if you watch on the DVD extras, you can see the kitchen scene with the what they call, that wasn't called stop motion, it was called go motion.
Yeah.
Because Phil Tippett had pioneered this thing where the interstitial frames between the things were blurred, so it would give the impression of movement. And the stuff that he does is fantastic. When he saw the CG models that they'd built for the T-Rex that they decided on, Phil Tippett famously said, "Well, I'm extinct now."
Yeah, that's right.
And that's the line that they took from him and put it into the film for Alan Grant when he talks about what's archaeology. So yeah, those three people then came together. Phil Tippett, interestingly, stayed on the picture after that to help with the animation, because the CG guys were all computer people. They didn't know anything about animation, whereas Phil Tippett knew everything about animation, nothing about computer. And the way that those two worked together is Phil Tippett created these things called dinosaur input devices, which were wireframe models of dinosaurs, which he could then help to animate, which then was used as data points to put into the animation system.
Yeah.
And so the long and the short of it is this combination of all three angles of it. You've got the CG, you've got the animation, and then you've got the practical dinosaurs. And the way that they're deployed is it's the perfect way, because each one is used for something different. So like you said, when you've got a close-up of a head, you've got a practical one. When you've got a long shot of the body, you've got a CGI one. Nowadays, not necessarily talking about Jurassic World, but what you might find is it would be all CGI, so there would be no practical version of a monster or a beast. But Jurassic Park just gets it, and the point that I'm making is that it was through necessity that they had to do these things. So they were solving this problem as they were going along, and the solution they came to was, you know, just created some movie magic. Whereas nowadays, it's the easy option is to go to the CGI route for everything. And so when your imagination and whatever you can do with it is limitless, it almost loses a little bit of that tangibility, I think.
Yeah.
And that's when you get some of this weird, like, weightlessness that you find with some of the animals and some of the sequences, especially in Jurassic World as well. I mean, that film is very guilty of that. I don't want to hate on Jurassic World because it does have its fans, but it just doesn't have the tangibility. And I just don't understand why they just went full CGI when they knew they had the skills to make, you know, the incredible models and all that sort of stuff.
Well, I think it leans quite nicely into a point that I think we're going to discuss. And that is, in my opinion, when it comes to studios like this leaning heavily on the CG, they're going for almost like visual overstimulation, right? They're just like, we can animate an entire field of dinosaurs, so you've never seen as many dinosaurs on screen. And as an audience, you'll have about 5 to 10 seconds where you go, oh, that's cool, but that's it. If that's just a 2-hour-long film, I think people forget this. Films are stories, or they should be stories, and you're telling an audience a story. So if all you have is just visual spectacle, visual spectacle, visual spectacle for 2 hours, it wears thin, and you have to just keep trying to one-up yourself. And that was something that stood out to me the first time I watched Jurassic World. So I went and saw it in the cinema like everybody else and thought, you know, yeah, this is visually impressive, but they're constantly trying to one-up themselves here by bombarding you with CG dinosaurs. And look, my inner child is delighted, you know, seeing all these animals on screen that I, like yourself, I grew up reading books and watching shows about and all sorts. But I'm not really getting anything from the story here because there isn't one. And I think that's where Jurassic Park differs greatly. Talk to us a bit more about that then, what this film does right in that way.
Yeah, well, I think you're totally right. I think if you compare the finales of Jurassic Park with that of Jurassic World, the Jurassic World has that famous sequence with the T-Rexes fighting the Indominus Rex, with the raptors attacking. And like Chris Pratt is peripherally on the board, on the edges of that scene. The other characters are peripherally on the edge of that scene. And it's just a CG spectacle, and then in the end, you know, they just even one up it one more with the mosasaur jumping out of the lake and pulling the Indominus Rex into the water. Whereas in Jurassic Park, you've got that absolutely stunning sequence which begins with, you know, Tim and Lex in the kitchen, and then it ends up, you know, they've got them, Alan and Ellie then coming back and then escaping through like the various like different tunnels, the vents, all that sort of stuff. You've got them into the lobby of Jurassic Park and falling and climbing on the skeletons in there, and it's just brilliantly done. They're in this museum of dinosaurs being attacked by dinosaurs that they've brought back to life themselves.
Yeah,
it's just the irony is all there. And it's always man versus, not monster, but man versus beast, man versus creature. That it's very tense. And yeah, in the end, the T-Rex comes in and sort of saves the day. But you're always focused on the human story.
Yeah.
It's always about the humans. And the animals they're like I said, it's the first time you're seeing dinosaurs brought to life. And you believe that they are real dangerous animals, And one of the things that they really look to do with this film is to move people away from what they thought they knew about dinosaurs.
Yeah.
And let's not beat about the bush. This film fundamentally changed the way that people thought about dinosaurs. Mm. That's not overselling it. That is 100% true. People before, you know, had this vision of lumbering dinosaurs, slow dinosaurs. And one of the first things that Jurassic Park wanted to do was show that these dinosaurs were fast. They were animalistic. They were dangerous. They were living, breathing creatures. And that this film, it really does it. And I forgot what my point was, but yeah, the finale brings all that together.
Yeah.
And you really care for the characters. And that's all been building up all the way through. And also the film shows how dangerous they are. There are characters that get picked off in horrible ways in this film. You know, Samuel L. Jackson's character dies in a horrible way. The lawyer character, Gennaro, gets killed in a horrible way. And yeah, like you were saying, it's like this idea of dinosaurs and how if you overdo it, then it loses its potency. Mm-hmm. After Jurassic Park came out, there were a lot of monster movies, a lot of creature movies, and we had the Walking with Dinosaurs TV program, all that sort of stuff. And it didn't take long for the novelty to wear off. It was only very short-lived. But it still remains the definitive dinosaur movie. I don't think there's been a dinosaur movie since that's lived up to it. Like I said, I like the second one, I like the third one. And they do some interesting stuff with the dinosaurs, but this one really, the dinosaurs are the stars.
Yeah, definitely. It's sort of diminishing returns after that.
Absolutely,
but,
yeah.
Mm. But yeah, so something I was fascinated by, because you sent me over a little video, kind of, I don't know what to just call it, a video essay, I guess?
Yeah, it's like a lecture, isn't it?
At
an event, yeah.
I think, I'll put a link to it in the show notes, people, because I encourage people to go and listen to this because it is fascinating. But the guy basically points out that there is this sort of different story or sort of layer to the film that's hidden underneath the surface, and it's a very human one, and you touched upon it earlier, and it's one of the responsibility of bringing life into the world and basically parenthood. Now at first, when he first said this, I went, no, surely not, and then I just listened and by the end of half an hour I could not believe I'd never thought of the film that way before. But I thought, it's genius, it's absolutely genius, and given where Spielberg was in his life and his career, it makes total sense that this is something he would have baked into the film.
Yeah, it's a lecture, I think, by a guy called Mike Hill, who is a visual artist that works in the film and video game industry, and it's called Spielberg's Subtext Jurassic Park Analysis. It's on YouTube, and yeah, it really does open your eyes to a lot of the stuff that's in the film that, you know, you thought this film was just a fun, entertaining blockbuster. But what he explains is that the reason this film endures is because of all the extra layers that are going on beyond the basic story.
Mm-hmm.
And one of those is, you know, it's clear that Ellie and Alan are together. This is Sam Neill and Laura Dern's characters. They're in a relationship. They're at a point in their relationship, and they even talk about it in the very first scene they're in together, about not wanting to have children. Alan's very resistant to the idea. Ellie's very open to the idea.
Mm-hmm.
And then they go to the island and they're confronted with this idea of bringing life into the world, you know, through the idea of the dinosaurs. And there's a lot of talk about, you know, the birth and the responsibility of doing that. And this is really all talking about Ellie and Alan's relationship with each other and whether they feel responsible enough to bring life into the world. And then you throw into the mix Tim and Lex, the two children who are going through a divorce. Their parents are going through a divorce and they're thrust into the situation. They then become, you know, the surrogate children for Alan and Ellie throughout the movie.
Yeah.
And when Alan and Ellie get separated, it really falls on Alan's shoulders to take responsibility for his children, something he's very uncomfortable with to start off with. And so the film is really all about his journey to accepting, you know, that there is, there's something, it awakens something within him, which again just speaks about the themes of the film. And really highly recommend watching this analysis, because like you say, you'll never watch Jurassic Park the same way ever again.
Yeah.
And it's just terrific. I mean, I wish I was as smart as this guy to have figured all this stuff out. But like he says the same sort of things that I've been going on about, which is, you know, why this film endures compared to something like Jurassic World, which I think, you know, I saw whenever it came out six, 7 years ago. I've tried to watch it since. I can't watch it. But Jurassic Park, I've seen more than it I would care to imagine more times. I've, you know, you talked about having the DVD. I've got a VHS copy of this. I've got a DVD yeah. copy of this. I've got a Blu-ray copy. I've got a digital copy. I've got special edition Blu-rays. I've got like every version imaginable of this film.
Yeah.
Because it just, it lives with me. And that's just something Spielberg has, I think. He has that power to bring something to life in such a vivid way, such a tangible way. And to have all that stuff in there. I mean, I guess the screenwriters must take some credit for it as well.
Yeah, totally.
Michael Crichton adapted the screenplay initially. Another screenwriter was brought on. I don't think her screenplay went down that well. And then David Coepp was the man that was brought in to do the final script, working very closely with Spielberg, obviously. And how explicit all this stuff is, I'm not sure. Like when you read interviews with, you know, Sam Neill and Laura Dern, they don't mention it as being something they talked about, but it is definitely all there. It asks real questions. The film asks real questions, and also allows the film to take its time asking the questions as well. You know, this is not just relegated to one scene towards the end of the film. Like, should we really be doing this? They don't hammer it home that, oh, this is really a film about procreation. It's all there under the surface for you to discover, under the surface of this thrilling movie that once it starts, just doesn't let go until the very final frame. It's amazing.
Yeah, and it's the kind of thing I think you need to have in these types of films. It's something that you mentioned earlier, you know, like the Jurassic Park sequels, the Godzilla ones recently, I think is a good example of films where, as far as visuals and spectacle go, it's great, but the characters, you don't care about them. And I'm not saying it's be horrible, it's just they're so poorly written that there's just nothing. And, you know, a sort of joke that, I've forgotten the chap's name, is it Mike, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, but a joke that sort of Mike made, in, I think, during the speech was like, do you remember Chris Pratt's character's name? You know, and it's like you have to think about it for a second. I'm like, yeah, is it Dave, is it Clive? And it's like, it's Owen. I'm like, oh yeah, you know. And it's a thing, it happens in a lot of these films where like it's nameless protagonist who's just, you know, there to save the day. They're the big Hollywood star, whatever. As you pointed out earlier, the main cast of this film were relatively unknown for the most part. And I think that was a good choice on Spielberg's part, because, you know, he just went and picked some good actors, gave them a real human story, something, you know, connections, something that they could kind of latch onto and ground to. And as you say, whether or not they picked up on some of the subtle themes is kind of irrelevant, because they were just playing real people, you know. And that's something that, as you say, like when you go back and watch the film over and over again, you can enjoy, you know. I quite enjoy the fact that Sam Neill is just kind of like this grumpy man for the first half of the film, and then kind of once everything kicks off with the T-Rex, it's like he has to switch, and it's something you buy into, you know, something you understand, and the journey he goes on with accepting kids and the idea of fatherhood is, I think, is absolutely there. And that's just one example of many characters in this film.
Yeah, and like you said, the film really worked. The fact that it's not start wall to wall movie stars really lends itself. I mean, these guys are all really well known actors now, and I would say they were fairly well known at the time, but these weren't like, you know, it wasn't Harrison Ford here. The film that, like I said, he was just coming off making was Hook, and you've got, you know, Dustin Hoffman, Robin Williams, Julia Roberts. He wasn't averse to working with stars.
Yeah.
But what he ended up with was terrific character actors, and that really, really helps. I was looking into it. Some of the other people they looked at for Alan Grant were Richard Dreyfuss. Obviously, he'd worked with on Close Encounters and Jaws, and you could see that working.
Yeah.
Kurt Russell, they also looked at, maybe a bit too action hero-y, but also William Hurt as well, which I couldn't imagine as Alan Grant. And the famous one they thought was maybe Harrison Ford would have been Alan Grant. Mm. And you can see that obviously with the hat. That makes total sense.
Yeah.
But I don't think he was, I don't think he wanted to be in a movie with dinosaurs. You know what he's like? He's famously quite grumpy.
Yeah.
But then around that, you know, you've got Wayne Knight as Dennis Nedry.
Yeah.
Who is just one of my favourite actors. Like, I love him in Seinfeld, and he's just perfect as, as Nedry. You've got Samuel L. Jackson, who at that point, you know, again, wasn't the Samuel L. Jackson we know now in every single franchise. He was just a really good character actor. Mm. Laura Dern, well known then for doing David Lynch films, but maybe not so much anything else. And again, she's an unusual choice for this. Like, she's quite a like, she's not what you would expect from a paleobotanist. Like, she's statuesque, she's striking, she's very like forthright in her opinions, you know. She's like not the demure like scientist that maybe you would have got with another film. And then obviously just got in Malcolm, Jeff Goldblum, who, you know, I think probably everyone knew from The Fly at that point. Who just, you know, steals the show with Ian Malcolm.
Absolutely.
I feel like the obsession with Ian Malcolm though has grown over the years. I feel like at the time I don't know if it was quite as striking as it is now, but like, you know, all the memes and the stuff that I think he's sort of grown into the character of being Jeff Goldblum, I think, more now. Whereas at the time, it was, he was very much a serious kind of character actor. But yeah, here's just a quote from Spielberg I pulled up. It says, "I wanted good, solid actors who weren't going to charge outrageous prices. I didn't want to spend $3 to $5 million a piece on actors for this movie. I was spending enough money to make the dinosaurs, and that was where I needed the money to go." And that just speaks volumes, really. Yeah. But then on the flip side, you've got one of the most famous actors, Richard Attenborough, playing what's his face? God.
Oh, I've blanked as well. Oh, no. Hang on one second.
Hammond.
Hammond. Oh, yeah. How do we both blank?
Who was coming off 15 years acting hiatus, who was one of the most famous directors of the time. You know, he'd won an Oscar for Gandhi.
That's right. Yeah, he had. Yeah.
And he is just absolutely perfect for the role. Reportedly, they wanted Sean Connery in that role. And that's why he's played Scottish. But I think the Scottish side comes from the book. But you could have seen Connery doing it, but maybe he was a bit too action hero. You did need someone who had the air of being a little bit foolish. And I think Attenborough really brings that to the film.
Oh, he does. Yeah, he has a sort of... It's funny, his character is kind of one that's... It's very soft and gentle. He has that sort of granddad feel to him. And I mean, he is literally a granddad as well in the story, which kind of lends itself to that. But he also has this other side to him. And it makes sense that you think, yeah, he's a man in this story that's supposed to have a lot of wealth and has built this park. So clearly he's got a bit of a more, I don't want to say sinister side, because in the book he is quite, you know, aggressive and sinister. But in this, he's more just like very sort of hardline when he wants to be, you know, doesn't like to be challenged, I think, which leads to some very interesting scenes later on. One of my absolute favourites is, you know, him and Ellie Sattler sitting in the cantina talking about the sort of the whole theme of the film, really, and talking about the fact that, you know, I think he says the line, "If we could control them," and she just loses it with him and is like, "You never had control. That's the illusion." And it's such a great little line. I'm like, I love it every time watching that scene, because it's such a great way of just shining a spotlight on it and this sort of this man's flaws.
Yeah, as the monologue about the flea circuit does it.
Yeah, that's right.
He just delivers it so perfectly.
Yeah.
It's just a brilliant moment. And again, one of those moments where the film is allowed to breathe. It takes its time. It, like, you know, gives you a moment to step away from the tension and really, like, just wallow in the themes of the film. Like, it's like, Yeah. It's slow, but it's deliberately slow, and it allows you to relax a little bit. Ready for the next, you know, big scare, I guess. And I guess that's something that you can also hark back to Jaws, right? Jaws has that similar pace in that, you know, you have moments of high drama, action, horror, and then great swathes of calm on the ocean while you're waiting for the shark to pop back up. And so, I guess him saying this is Jaws on land is actually quite accurate in that way.
Yeah, yeah. I know it's one of those that's often paired together in sort of special cinema releases, and I think it makes total sense. You can see these two working really well together as a back-to-back, very similar in their themes.
Definitely.
Another character I just clocked, I don't think we've mentioned him yet, Muldoon, played by Ted Peck. I mean, I love that guy. When he's on the screen, he's so good at that role. He's so, so believable.
Yeah, he really rocks those like long socks and shorts.
Yeah,
and totally believable as this guy, as the game. Is he the gamekeeper? I can't know how they describe him, but
yeah,
he is like, he's almost like from another film, isn't he? He's like this very stoic character, and he has an excellent delivery. You know, he sees through Hammond's BS. And is there doing his job, you know, he's very much there to keep the animals in line.
Yep.
And I don't know if you remember, Jurassic Park 2, The Lost World. It's got this terrific character played by Pete Postlethwaite called Roland Tembo.
That's right.
Who absolutely steals the film.
He does.
And he's very much like the flip side of, Muldoon, I think, in that he's this gamekeeper who's like into like the animals.
To collect my fee. Yeah.
But he's like, you know, if Muldoon had gone like fallen to the dark side, it would have been Roland Tembo.
Yes. But
yeah, every scene that Muldoon is in, he just, he just delivers, doesn't he? And then he's obviously got that fantastic death scene where he's stalking the raptors and they're stalking him, and then he gets to deliver the clever girl line, which is just great.
That has to go down as well as one of the most iconic lines in cinema, doesn't it? Like this film has some great lines, but that's probably the one that stands out above the rest. It's like, if you think Jurassic Park, you think clever girl. And like you said, that scene is it's so tense. I mean, you can literally see the beads of sweat coming off the man's face.
You really can, and that's another example of them using practical puppets.
Yes.
And there's a brilliant behind the scenes picture which shows the raptor on Muldoon's chest, and the raptor is just all like mechanical stuff underneath it, and then he's just acting against this thing attacking him on his face. It is it's an amazing amazing piece of filmmaking. But it's packed with like terrific characters. Even the guy who Nedry meets in wherever the bar is, Dodson, who's only on screen for that one scene. You know, he's got the funny hat and the Hawaiian shirt on. He's terrific. I think that character's coming back in the next Jurassic World film.
I heard some conflicting things on that. I heard that he might be, but also, I'm not going to speculate. Let me just quickly pull up the man's IMDb.
Well, I think the actor who played him in Jurassic Park ended up being
in prison. Let's just say
sex
that.
Offender. Yeah.
Yeah. That's. Which is unfortunate, but the character might come back. You're right. Yeah, it says he's in prison. That's a shame. But that's another one though. I talk about like a sort of quotable moment of the film. Yeah. Dodson, we got Dodson here.
We got Dodson, yeah.
Nobody cares.
Yeah. Don't get cheap on me, Dodson.
Yeah.
He sprays the whipped cream on top of, not whipped, shaving cream on top of someone's dessert.
That's right, yeah. Yeah.
Well, it's like that whole thing, isn't it? Yeah, I don't know if you've ever read the screenwriting books by, is it Robert McKee or whatever? And it's like, to indicate someone's a real, like, bad guy, make them do something dreadful, like, within the first few minutes of seeing them on screen. And that's his moment, isn't it? It's putting the shaving cream on someone else's dessert. Yeah. It's terrific.
Yeah. But he gets his comeuppance mind, with the Dilophosaurus. I mean,
absolutely.
That just makes me shudder.
Yeah, I mean, the film's got three sort of standout dinosaur moments for me. The T-Rex in the paddock. You've got the raptors in the kitchen, and then you've got the Dilophosaurus attack with Dennis Nedry.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that what really makes that scene as well is the sound design. When I think about it, I can hear the rain. I can hear the chirping of the animals. Mm-hmm. I think they actually even like flew specifically to Australia to record the sounds of animals that you wouldn't hear in America. I think they deliberately went to like exotic places. I mean, Australia's not that exotic, but you know what I mean? it's got rainforests. But that the sound design in that really, really adds to the menace. And also because it's a small dinosaur, you think, you might be all right.
Yeah, because I think early in the film, you don't see it, do you? They go past, and so you don't really know what you're looking for. And when it turns up, you're like, oh, just a little one. And then it turns, and you're like, oh no, that's really scary.
And it just keeps escalating. He's like, first of all, like, you know, he's worried about this dinosaur because it's closing in on him. And then it spits in his eyes, and then he gets in your car, and you think, oh, he's going to be all right. He's going to escape.
Yeah.
And then it's in there in the car with him and absolutely destroys him. And that scene ends with the thing in the coolant, all the embryos rolling away from the car. And I always thought that's such a terrific way of setting up a sequel, and they never return to it. Such a shame.
Yeah, that's true. I did think they would have come back to that, but I don't know. Maybe that was something off screen in the sort of in between of that and Jurassic World. Who knows? But
who knows?
But yeah, truly amazing, amazing moment. I just remembered actually when I was a kid, my dad bought me one of those as a toy. And it was like an electric one that when you press the button, it's those big, I don't know what you call them, like glands or things that just flapped up and shook.
The frills, yeah.
The frills, that's it. Yeah, yeah.
It's probably a good time to talk about the merchandising for the film as well, because
it's such a
well-merchandised film as you'd expect from films of this era. But I was up in my loft the other day and looking around, and I found a bag, and it had the original Jurassic Park cups that I'd collected from McDonald's. you know, if you'd bought like a big drink or something, you would get it in a plastic cup that you could keep. And I had like three of those. They're basically so fragile and brittle now. They're not like worth like looking at, but like I've still got them.
Yeah, of course.
Still got them. But I remember also the toys that you could get. I was probably a little bit old for dinosaurs toys by the time it came out, you know, 11, 12, going into secondary school. But the toys were terrific. I don't know if you remember, but there was a specific type that had like what they called builders, like realistic flesh on the dinosaurs. So they were like rubberized dinosaurs. And they felt like unlike any, you know, like, they used to be like hard plastic toys, but these were like rubberized and soft, and the heads were articulated. You could squeeze the T-Rex head and it would like open its mouth to roar like in a specific way. They were just so good. And the cars as well. It was such a merchandisable type film. I had toys. In fact, I've still got an Alan Grant somewhere. Just looking to see if he's on my shelf now. No, I don't. I think he's there, but, yeah, that again, that all adds to the mystique, you know, of something, and helps, I guess, when you're seeing a film at that age, it all adds to the experience. It all becomes part of it, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Something else, just while I think about it, that I remember about the film coming out and seeing it for the first time, where I grew up in Lincolnshire, the local newspaper was the Lincolnshire Echo.
Mm-hmm.
And I vividly remember I was very excited about Jurassic Park coming out. There was no internet, so you couldn't pore over like anything to find information out. But like I would look through the Lincolnshire Echo.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the stories I remember reading was that this film was coming to the Lincoln Ritz. That was our local cinema. And it was so thrilling, it wouldn't have an interval. And I just remember my mind being blown that the idea that this film that I was excited for, Jurassic Park, was so thrilling.
Yeah.
They couldn't put an in. There was no way you could have an interval in it. You had to see it from start to finish. It was that exciting.
Makes sense.
Yeah. And I don't think I've been and seen a film with an interval since. I don't think.
Yeah, I forget that was like common practice in a lot of movies. But
Yeah, I guess it's just to sell more sweets, but
yes, but no, I think something like this, you're right, it's so perfectly balanced in terms of its tension and sort of quiet moments and going up and down that, yeah, if you sort of paused it in the middle, you'd lose that momentum that it's building definitely. Up so nicely throughout.
Yeah, definitely. I think I've aged myself a little bit there, but
I don't know. Well, it's not to make you feel any worse, but the only story I know about this film when it came out was that my mum and dad went to see it together, and it was one of their like first proper dates, I think. That's a story my father told me.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah. But
I was talking to my older brother. He wasn't someone that I grew up with, but he was staying with us at the time when Jurassic Park came out.
Right.
And he tells me that he took us to see Jurassic Park at the Lincoln Ritz.
Yeah.
And we were so excited that he was taking us. And he was excited because my dad said he could drive my dad's car to take us to the cinema. My dad had a BMW or something at the time. But we were like, no, can Simon take us in his car? And so he was like just absolutely gutted that we'd made him drive his Renault Clio to the cinema when he thought he was going to be driving this BMW there.
Oh, bless.
It's just a funny story that he told me the other day and reminded me of it. It's just it's funny what you remember, isn't it? But it's just one of those films I remember vividly reading the book and being completely lost in it. You know when you're reading a book,
yeah,
and it transports you and you're in that world. Like, I find it very, very, I think when your imagination is very fertile at that age,
yeah,
that it's easier to do at a younger age. And
absolutely.
I think, you know, as an adult now reading books, I very rarely find myself being transported somewhere else. Like, I can imagine this stuff, but like, you know.
Yeah.
But I remember reading this stuff and like reading about like the humidity of the jungles and like, you know, how like a dinosaur skin felt and all this stuff and just like being there. And then that film gave me that same experience, I think. And then I don't know if you remember when the trailer came out for The Lost World.
Vaguely, yeah.
It's got such a terrific teaser trailer. I would absolutely implore anyone listening to this to seek out the teaser trailer for The Lost World, because it gives nothing away about the film, but it gives you the sounds of the jungle. It gives you the boom of the footsteps. It gives you the rain.
Yes.
And it's like something has survived or something like that. I can't remember.
Yeah.
And I remember seeing that at the cinema and just being like, holy crap. Like, there's another Jurassic Park coming out. Again, this is like before internet. This is before I was reading like Empire or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
You'd learn about films through a trailer for a film. Imagine you're like that now. Like, it just doesn't happen, does it? I don't know about you, but like, I watch every trailer that comes out as soon as it comes out.
I tend to, funny enough, at the time of recording, I think what will probably be the final Jurassic film for now is due to come out, and the trailer for that came out recently, and yeah, absolutely, I sat and watched it on my phone, because as you say, that's just what we do now. And I think they've released quite a bit from that film, like maybe even the opening of it, apparently, like, and what a contrast that is to, as you say, the first sequel that all those years ago, where it was just a soundbite.
Yeah.
Nothing else, you know.
Yeah.
That was all you needed, right?
Yeah. I guess the point I'm trying to get to is just like, I don't know how much of it is wrapped up in nostalgia,
right?
Some of it, but also the fact that it's just a terrific movie.
Yeah.
I guess seeing it at a pivotal time in your life, and then it really capturing your attention. But the fact that it stayed with me for so long, I saw a lot of films at that age, right? I don't talk about, like, I don't know, Men in Black like I do this. I guess the only other film of this era that I really obsess over is Twister, which is a few years later.
Yeah.
But I love that movie so much. Not as much as Jurassic Park, though.
Uh-huh. Well, no, I can relate. I enjoyed that one very much as well. But yeah, I know what you mean. I think there's a reason why this film has endured the way it has. And I think we've touched upon a couple of those key points. It is really like a perfect storm of all those things coming together, and I'm with you. I don't hate the sequels, but it is diminishing returns. And I'm at the point where I'm like, well, it's, you know, like Jaws to other shark movies. It's like, yeah, you're never going to top it. But,
yeah.
You know, but that's okay. You know, I mean, we still got the original. We can still go back and appreciate it for what it is.
Yeah, it's like having a hamburger when you've had like the best steak of your life, isn't it? It's,
right. Yeah.
Like, you want the steak again. You don't want the. You'll have the hamburger because you're hungry.
Yeah. Yeah. You'll take what you could get, but it won't be Oh, man. Tom, I've really loved this discussion. I just want to know, was there anything else, any sort of key points you wanted to bring out?
No, I mean, I was going to tell you about going to Hawaii. I went to...
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. I've been to the Jurassic Park Ranch, the Kerr. I'm not going to say it, but this was part of a press trip for Jurassic World when that came out. So that came out in 2015.
Oh, okay.
And when the Blu-ray DVD was released, they flew a load of press out there. I was lucky enough to go out there. And luckily go with a couple of people I knew really well. So it ended up being a really nice experience. We stayed in this lovely hotel that's by the by, but one of the parts was they actually took us to the ranch where they filmed Jurassic Park.
Brilliant.
And so I've been to this I think it's called the Kualoa Ranch, where they also filmed Lost as well. And I'm a big Lost fan, so
okay.
I would highly recommend going. But you do like you can do like quad bike tours, and they take you around all the locations that they filmed Jurassic Park in. You can go to the paddock where the Gallimimus do their flocking, and they've even got a tree there, you know, like that they hide behind, and there's a big Jurassic Park sign.
Incredible.
And the tour people are like, yeah, this is the tree used in Jurassic Park, and they were like, yeah, well, it's not quite. It's like it's probably about the third one that's been there since the film was made. They basically just chop down a tree and put it there because the tourists just go crazy for it, and it just rots.
Yeah.
But that was absolutely a phenomenal experience, getting to explore that. And when you go there, you can see really why they chose that location for it. It's a very primal, you know, back to nature sort of location. Steven Spielberg said that they look, because the film, Isla Nublar, where the film is set or the book is set, I think is in Puerto Rico. And they looked at Puerto Rico and a few other, I think the Philippines maybe, to find somewhere tropical for them to shoot. And in the end, they chose Hawaii, I think, because it had nice hotels and was easy to get to.
Fair enough.
You can totally understand. But yeah, they built so many of the sets practically on location. And so, well, actually, when we were there, we were able to visit some of the Jurassic World sets that were still standing. And I think they might still be up, like the Indominus Rex pen. You could go in there and wander around and see where it scratched the walls and all that sort of stuff.
Okay.
But yeah, I mean, if anyone's ever going to Hawaii, I would definitely 100% recommend visiting the ranch where they filmed Jurassic Park, because it will transport you to being, and they've even got like big gate, Jurassic Park gates for when you're going in on your quad bikes. It feels like you're really there. There's no dinosaurs there, sadly, yet. Well, interesting, fun fact, actually, there was only ever one dinosaur on set of Jurassic Park, and it was the Triceratops.
Right.
It was laid on the floor, yeah. That was the only one they transported out there. Everything else was filmed on sound stages. But yeah, I would highly, absolutely dream come true experience to be able to do that. I feel incredibly blessed that I was able to do that. It's somewhere I've always wanted to go. And so when the opportunity arose, I really, really took it. Unfortunately, I got food poisoning on my last day there.
Oh, dear.
And I didn't get to interview Steven Spielberg, but it was great to be there. And would definitely recommend if you ever get the chance to go. And it's an amazing place.
No, Matt, I'd love to do that. I'm quite envious of you there. And hopefully someday you'll get to speak to Spielberg, no doubt.
Yeah. Interestingly, I've managed to tick off speaking to Sam Neill. I interviewed him for...
Brilliant.
Hunt for the Wilder People. So that was cool. Great.
Yeah.
I interviewed Jeff Goldblum for Thor Ragnarok.
Awesome.
And I would say you don't really interview Jeff Goldblum.
No.
You just go into a room and he starts talking.
Yeah.
And then that's it. Your 5 minutes is up. And then Laura Dern, I spoke to her for Star Wars, The Last Jedi.
Nice.
So I've ticked off the main three. Spielberg,
brilliant.
I'd love to speak to, but I think, you know, unless you got like 2 hours with him, I don't think you're going to get much memorable out of him. But Wayne Knight would be the one, I think, would be, I'd love to meet Wayne Knight and speak to him, because he's just a big hero of mine. And I have interviewed Sam Jackson, actually, but yeah, I think people forget he's in this film, don't they?
Yeah, that, like you say at the time, a small sort of role, character actor. And yeah, it is one of those, every time I watch it with somebody, they go, oh yeah, Sam Jackson's in this. It's like, yes, he is. Like, you're right, we always just forget because he's such a quiet and sort of reserved character as opposed to his usual self.
Yeah, that's right. He really leaned into that sort of bombastic. Well, he just became Nick Fury, didn't he? Like, yep. I think that was like,
this is it.
That's, I guess it was maybe Pulp Fiction was next, and then that really set him on this new trajectory.
Yes, for sure.
But yeah, I mean, I guess in summary, I would say, you know, this is, if anyone ever asks me, this is my favorite film of all time. It's like, it's been on that top for a while. It used to be Empire Strikes Back. I think I've grown out of that a little bit.
Okay.
But Jurassic Park is my favorite movie of all time. Like, unashamedly, I'll tell you anyone that, you know.
Yes.
If, yeah. Just trying to think of a pretentious director, but like, I would tell them it was Jurassic Park. Do you know what I mean?
Because yes.
It's just a great movie. And if you think, you know, you've seen it, go, if you ever get the chance to see it at the cinema, because if you haven't seen it at the cinema, then you really owe it to yourself to see it on the big screen with the sound.
Yeah.
Immersed in the effects, immersed in the experience. You will not regret it. Definitely will not regret it.
Absolutely. Well, Tom, thank you so much for coming on, man. I've really enjoyed this. I guess to take us home, where can the good people find you if they're listening?
My best place to find me is, I'm on Twitter at Tom Butler. That's TOMBUTLER. I also host a podcast as well. You've had a couple of my co-hosts on your show. It's called the James Bond A to Z podcast. It's not about Jurassic Park, sadly.
Yet.
But it is about one of my other passions. Yeah, not yet. It is about one of my other passions, the 007 films. And we post a new episode every week. It's going through the creatives and the stories behind the films in an A to Z format. And we've done, I think, like 10 of the films so far, so we're working through, we're getting there. I think we'll be wrapped up by the end of this year, but yeah, I'd love if people enjoyed this to come and have a listen to the James Bond A to Z. And yeah, we're on that podcast, is, it can be found at James Bond A to Z, A-T-O-Z. Yeah,
that's right. And I'll be putting links to all of it, and yeah, I do recommend it. As you say, your co-hosts were kind enough to come on the show, and funny enough, we talked about James Bond, so that's something for people to go and check out and absolutely follow. I listened to a few episodes, it's well worth keeping up with. I think you guys are doing brilliant work.
Thank you.
So yeah, I guess all that's left to say is, Tom, thank you so much for coming on.
Well, thank you, Harley, it's been a pleasure. I really enjoy listening to your podcast as well. It's I've learned a lot of different things about a lot of different subjects, so yeah, it's always a pleasure to be able to come on. Thank you.
Brilliant. Well, thank you very much.
And there we have it. A huge thank you to Tom for coming onto the podcast and sharing your love of this magnificent film. I think you guys will agree with me when I say that that was a truly amazing conversation with some absolutely eye-opening revelations and insights into this film. I've linked into the show notes the video that we talked about, Mike Hill's Subtext of Jurassic Park. It's an excellent video. Highly recommend you go and check that out, as well as Tom's podcast, the James Bond A to Z podcast. Some of you may remember that a few episodes ago, I was fortunate enough to have on his co-hosts Tom and Brendan to talk about, well, funny enough, James Bond. You can go and check out that episode if you haven't already. It's a great listen, and their podcast is absolutely a must hear for anyone who loves James Bond. As ever, I want to give a huge thank you as well to the resident artist for the show, Alex. If you like the look of the logo and the Twitter banners that I have for this show, make sure you look up his details in the show notes. You can commission him for your very own artwork as well. And of course, I want to give a massive thank you to you, dear listener. If this is your first time listening to Fundamentals, well, thank you so much for checking out this podcast and this episode. Make sure you go back and have a look at the back catalogue. There are now over 50 episodes for you to enjoy. Really, the aim of this podcast is simple. It's exploring pop culture, one conversation at a time. So if that's something that you'd be interested in, then make sure you give us a follow, a like, a subscribe, whatever it is you have to do on your favourite podcatcher to stay up to date with episodes. They come out on a fortnightly basis. And I do plan on doing a few specials as well to sprinkle in for good measure this year. So make sure you stay tuned for those. If you are enjoying the show, you've been supporting it for a little while, and you want to go one step further to supporting me, there are a couple of ways you can do that. It's really straightforward. The best way, and it's free, which is also a bonus, is to simply tell people about the podcast. You can share it on your social medias. If you do that, tag me. That's all in the show notes. You can follow me on social media. Let me know you've done that. You can also leave a review or a rating. 5 stars is the preferable one because it gets people to find this podcast. You can do that on a number of platforms. And if you've been kind enough to do so and I've missed it, then please make sure you contact me by the details in the show notes, because I'd love to thank you personally on this very podcast. If you've gone that far to support me, the least I could do is give you a shout out, right? And of course, the other thing you can do if you want to send a little bit of money my way for the podcast is to go and have a look at the merch that is in the TeePublic store. I'm really happy with some of the designs we have there. I've put links in the show notes again. You can go and check that out. They do periodic sales, so make sure you swoop in at the right moment. Grab yourself a t-shirt, a mug, a laptop case, whatever it is you fancy with the incredible artwork by Alex on there. Again, if you do that, tag me in the social medias with a picture or something just to tell me that you've done that, because I would love to see it out in the wild. I would love to thank you for doing so. And it would just be amazing to see, really. Again, they're amazing designs. You can find them all in the TeePublic store linked in the show notes. Right, that's enough rambling from me. I'll be back again in a few weeks' time with a completely different guest on a completely different subject. So make sure you're followed, you're subscribed, all that good stuff, and I will see you next time. Jurassic Park.